From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The White House top economic advisor said today he can't guarantee that taxes won't go up for some middle-class families under the president's tax overhaul plan. The plan was unveiled yesterday and calls for tax cuts for businesses and for individuals. The White House says it's aimed at the middle class. Joining us now is Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon. He's the ranking member on the Senate Finance Committee. Senator, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
And what do you think of the plan outlined by the president yesterday on taxes?
Well, I think what's striking is this claim that this is going to produce a miracle for the middle class is absurd. If this framework is all about the middle class, then Trump Tower is middle class housing. This proposal, based on the limited information we have, violates the president's tax pledge that the rich would not gain at all. And then there's a whole new way to basically skirt taxes for Mar-a-Lago's loyal members.
What do you mean by that? What's the new way to skirt taxes?
Well, what they do is they create something called a pass-through. And essentially, a pass-through has been for small business people. You know, we're talking about a cleaner, we're talking about a restaurant, we're talking about a garage. But what they're going to do is essentially create this new Grand Canyon-sized break for the very well-to-do by saying, well, those folks will get treated like pass-throughs too. They get a much lower tax rate of 25%. And in the process, Social Security and Medicare are going to get hurt because their income would be treated as business income rather than ordinary income, where they'd be subject to Social Security and Medicare taxes.
What do you think of having three different rates, 12, 25, and 35? Is that acceptable to you?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that, again, this is another violation of the president's pledge. You know, right now, the top rate for folks in America is 39.6. So the president, right out of the gate, lowers that to 35. That's a break for folks at the top. For folks at, in effect, the bottom of the economic ladder, he takes their rates up from 10 to 12%. Now, the president makes a big deal about how you'd have a working class couple getting a doubling of the standard deduction. Well, that sounds like an extra $12,000. But they would simultaneously lose, if they, say, had four kids, $16,000 in their personal and dependent tax exemptions. So what you're talking about is one hand giveth, the other hand taketh away, and you have a net tax increase based on what we know for a lot of hardworking families that are pretty big and have some kids.
Now, the president has made the case that he thinks his tax cut proposal will boost jobs and wages. Let's listen to him speaking yesterday in Indianapolis.
This is a revolutionary change, and the biggest winners will be the everyday American workers as jobs start pouring into our country, as companies start competing for American labor, and as wages start going up at levels that you haven't seen in many years.
How do you respond to that line of argument that maybe by cutting taxes in this way, you're going to boost jobs and boost wages?
We have seen this movie before. You know, what we're talking about is a $5 trillion plus program disproportionately skewed to folks at the top. And so this is trickle-down economics. You may get a sugar high in the short term, but as the program evolves, what happens is you see businesses not having the certainty and predictability that we need. You see the debts rise. Look, they've tried this places before. Kansas is one, and it's been a disaster.
So, Senator, President Trump was with a Democratic senator when he made this announcement yesterday. Do you think that you and your fellow Democrats are going to be united in opposition to this tax cut proposal?
I can tell you that Democrats overwhelmingly believe that history shows that these kind of big tax cuts don't pay for themselves. The 2001, 2003 Bush tax cuts were billed as tax relief for the middle class that would spark economic growth. Instead, the benefits skewed to the fortunate few, added trillions to the national debt, and after a few years, they were starting to work to unravel it. So the middle class get little or nothing out of this. The president's friends get a tremendous amount out of it. And if he thinks this is for the middle class, I really do think Trump Tower is middle class housing.
So do you think that the Democrats will all be united against this?
I can tell you that the overwhelming number of Democrats have already signed a letter making it clear we've staked out the principles like fiscal responsibility, which this approach just throws in the trash can. And I think Democrats are going to say, hey, spending trillions of dollars in tax cuts now without a plan to pay for them is going to really do a lot of damage to Social Security and Medicare.
I want to ask you one more thing while we have you, Senator. What do you think of President Trump's response to Puerto Rico so far?
I think it's been wholly inadequate. I went to the floor of the Senate last night. These are American citizens in Puerto Rico. We don't turn our back on American citizens who are suffering the way these folks are. And I think particularly now we have begun to see just how extraordinary the reach is of this damage. And so I think the response has been very inadequate, and I hope the Trump administration will step up.
That's Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon and ranking member on the Senate Finance Committee. Senator, thank you.
Thanks. Look forward to talking again.
Well, Puerto Rico is looking for truck drivers to replace those who can't get to their trucks. If you are one, call 469-401-9603. We'll post that number at herenow.org. You're to leave your trucker's license number on the answer machine. And there will be more fuel for the trucks. Today, the president waived the Jones Act, which restricts shipping from foreign companies. The president had already waived it for Florida and Texas after hurricanes there, but not for Puerto Rico after Maria. He said he was worried about the impact on U.S. shipping. After pressure, ships with precious fuel can now come in. Today we found Liz Marie Vasquez Martinez, a first grade teacher, standing in line for gas.
Well, right now we have been standing in line for 3 hours.
3 hours. And is the gas rationed? I understand you can only get a certain amount.
Yeah, we can only, it depends on the gas station. Sometimes we can get only $15.
Yeah.
The top, it's $40. Not more than that.
And yesterday, we understand you were at the Costco. What's happening there? Because at some grocery stores, we know they're just opening the door for 20 people at a time. What was Costco like?
Yes, Costco, it was really organized yesterday,
mm-hmm.
but the lines were too long. Only 2 hours.
2 hours just to go in?
Yes, to go in, yes. And you can only get some things. Like, for example, if you want water, not more than 3 packs. And if you want food, it's also limited.
Yeah. Look, we also know you're a teacher. What's your sense of what's going to happen in the school systems?
Well, right now, the parents are being very cooperative, coming in and cleaning up. So we think that maybe for October, some schools may get started, but they don't have light and they don't have water.
Right. Well, you also traveled to Villalba, which is more in the center of the island where your fiancé's family lives. And we know it's just totally out of communication with other parts of the island and very hard to get in. What did you see when you got there?
Yes. I already know that some people needed dialysis and they couldn't, so they died. And we're, like, very hurt for that. There's a neighborhood called Apiaderos. A really, really, really big rock falls from the mountains and blocked all the ways into that neighborhood. So no cars can get inside. Mm-hmm. So neighbors have to get some cots and put the person on top of the cot so they can walking, get that person out of the neighborhood and try to get some help.
Wait, did you see this? Did you see people being taken on cots out of a neighborhood? And what was their issue?
Yes. Some people needed oxygen, some people needed dialysis, and they were like a day stuck on their house.
Oh, dear. So what do you know, are you already thinking about how you might talk to first grade kids when they come back to school?
Well, first of all, the kids like to talk a lot, and they like to talk about their experience. So it would be nice to hear them, what they survived, what they lived during the hurricane, because they have never experienced something like this.
Yeah.
And then we can talk about what happened out there, besides their family, besides what they lived, what also happened out there, how can we manage to maybe prepare better for another occasion. Start slowly like that,
yeah.
One step at a time.
Yeah. That's Liz Marie Vasquez Martinez, a first grade teacher from Toa Alta, Puerto Rico, standing on a line at a gas station. She's been there 3 hours. Liz Marie, thanks so much for talking to us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to what has been happening here.
Ta-Nehisi Coates could have made his new book a compilation of his essays as national correspondent for The Atlantic and just left it at that. But this is Ta-Nehisi Coates. In his best-selling book, Between the World and Me, he writes to his then 15-year-old son, "I tell you now that the question of how one should live within a black body is the question of my life." And indeed, over and over, he takes that question, chews on it, spits it out, then chomps on it again, first on his blog, then his magazine articles, then his books. His new book includes not just his essays, but a reevaluation of them. Did they hold up? What would he have done differently? The book is We Were 8 Years in Power, an echo of the words of South Carolina Congressman Thomas Miller in 1895, as the promise of post-Civil War reconstruction mutated into a re-oppression of blacks under Jim Crow. And Ta-Nehisi Coates joins us now from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
How would you characterize this? I mean, I kind of see it as you know, thinking about what you wrote along the way over the past 8 years, is that an accurate depiction of it?
Yeah, that's pretty good. I think you had it exactly right. I mean, initially, I was signed up just to do, you know, kind of best of collection. I'd done a number of essays for The Atlantic, and the thought was these could be packaged together. Brief introduction and a brief intro-outro. And as I started looking back at the work and I started looking back at some of the blogging I had done in that period, I thought there might be something more.
And of course, I mentioned the title, We Were 8 Years in Power. You are now talking about the 8 years of the Obama administration. How are you characterizing them, given that you're referencing 1895?
The first part of that, as you mentioned, it comes from Congressman Thomas Miller, and he is grappling with the question, why, after a period of Reconstruction, when a generation of black people coming out of slavery who were given the keys of governance in, you know, collaboration with white citizens who had worked with them in South Carolina, they'd done a pretty responsible and remarkable job. Mm-hmm. Why it was that South Carolina answered that by stripping them of their rights? In much the same way, I think there's some question after these past 8 years of, you know, a relatively scandal-free government. Doesn't mean you have to agree with everything Obama did. I think Obama was right about everything, but you know, he certainly held himself up as presentable and, you know, as an honorable person in the tradition of American presidents. Why was the response to that, you know, as I write, you know, this kind of oafish man who, for the first time in American history, was invited into the White House having never served in the military, having never served in any political office? Mm. And I think it's one of the more vexing questions of African-American life.
Well, what's your answer?
My answer is the answer of W.E.B. Du Bois, who answered that in South Carolina, but I think this speaks to America at large. The only thing white South Carolina feared more than bad Negro government was good Negro government. Hmm. That, in fact, the accomplishments were actually the problem, because the accomplishments, the presentation of black people as normal in their, you know, sort of bourgeois, everyday, easily integratable manner into America actually was an attack on whiteness and white supremacy in and of itself. It attacked the very precepts of that idea. And I think that explains a lot about what happened over the last 8 years and why the reaction was what it was.
Well, and of course, President Trump's many supporters would say, you know, many different things. And one of the things they'd say is that because they're tired of government in general, that they wanted change, that their jobs were disappearing. I'm going to put that aside because you respond to that as well. But can I ask you a question?
Sure.
About this moment in time? Because one of the things we read about is, you know, your growth as a writer. You go from somebody who didn't have a paycheck to somebody who's much acclaimed. But with that came something that you seem to be uncomfortable with, which is being cast as the interpreter of all things black, as you got called up by white journalists like me to comment on current events. And I want to ask you to comment on current events. How do you feel about that?
I don't mind people calling me up to ask me about current events. I wish there was more space, though. There is an unfortunate tradition in this, you know, dialogue of quote-unquote race relations in this country where people are selected at various moments to be spokespeople, you know, for what right now is a, you know, a community of 40 million people. You know, obviously I write and I write for the public and I want my thoughts considered. I want my writings considered. But I didn't ask for a crown. Mm. And that's kind of what has happened, honestly, to be straight with you. Because with that comes assumptions about, you know, what you're saying and what you're supposed to do. You lose some of your freedoms as a writer. You lose your ability to be curious in public because, you know, you have a crown on now. You're supposed to have the answers. It is probably the most regrettable development.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, personally for me out of the past 8 years.
Well, and you write that your success is directly tied to Barack Obama's presidency. You know, he's directly responsible for a crop of black writers and commentators. And you're absolutely right, because we remember in the run-up, in the campaign, yes, of course we had sources, but suddenly everybody was scrambling to get more.
And that was good and bad, you know? Like, it was good from the perspective, as you said, I didn't have a career before Barack Obama. And I don't think I would have had one, at least like I have now, if not for, you know, I have to be honest about that. In some ways, it opened up a market, you know? And there are, and I don't want to, in my own protestings, erase the fact that there are a number of incredible, incredible black journalists who sprung up in the wake of Obama. My friend Jelani Cobb at the New York and Nicole Hannah-Jones at the New York Times Magazine, a number of people were just, you know, writing beautifully because I largely think as an indirect result of Obama, people were much more curious about black life.
Well, what I wanted to ask you about, I thought of when I was reading your essay, Fear of a Black President. This is the essay you wrote about Barack Obama. You talk about how this black president, you know, might have unleashed the white supremacist forces that you talked about because of the title of the piece, Fear of a Black President. But as I was reading it, one stanza from poet Lucille Clifton seemed to feel so much a part of today. You were talking about how people become, you know, radicalized. That you write, my own father went to Vietnam dreaming of John Wayne, but came back quoting Malcolm X. Can you read a little of that stanza?
They act like they don't love their country. No, what it is they found out their country don't love them.
Hmm. Of course, I'm thinking of NFL football players taking a knee.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And not just them taking a knee, but the response to them taking a knee. You know, there was a game in which the Dallas Cowboys were able to draw a kind of compromise between themselves and their owner, who's totally against Colin Kaepernick's protest and kneeling before the flag, where they kneeled before the national anthem, not while the national anthem was playing, but before the national anthem. They got booed anyway, which, you know, clearly demonstrates that there is something going on beyond, you know, some degree of disrespect for the flag and the national anthem.
Look, Ta-Nehisi Coates, that 2012 essay about Barack Obama was one you felt worked, but you start your new book right off with your 2008 Bill Cosby essay, and you don't hold back. You say in every piece, the essays, there's a story I told and a story I didn't, for better or worse. In the case of Bill Cosby, it was for worse. This was my shame. This was my failure. And it's how this story starts. And then we launch into reading your Bill Cosby essay, in which you don't really talk about the accusations against him.
Yeah, it was a huge failure. You know, all these pieces come from deeply personal places, and they aren't really separable from my life. And at that point, as I, you know, articulated at the beginning of the book, I was an incredibly struggling writer. I had no, like, real notion of what was coming or what I was going to become. Later on, I became much more courageous about times when I needed to have confrontations with my editors. Mm. But I was aware of those allegations. And I think, you know, in my mind, I was writing one piece, and to have to try to write this other piece would have really, really complicated it. And I didn't know whether I was capable of it. This is my first shot at the Atlantic. It's my first piece, you know, of this length at a magazine like this. So why not narrow the story? In fact, what I know now is it would have dovetailed perfectly with it, and it would have complicated it in a really, really beautiful way. Mm. But that was a failure.
Overall, What would you say about your body of work? Because as you well know, especially after your book to your son came out, there were other black writers in particular who said, wait, this is way too cynical. What was it? Thomas Chatterton Williams. A woefully skewed way of looking at the world. Unlike Baldwin, he wrote a letter book to his nephew. You were writing to your son. He had so much more hope than you seem to have, it would seem.
I don't think so. No? You know what I think? I think for a very, very long time, the vast majority of this country has been spoon-fed its history as though they were two-year-old children. This is about intellectual maturity. I know there is a desire to be read a bedtime story and to be patted on the head and told, in the end, the good guys win. But no one actually knows whether that's true. And that hasn't been true for, you know, generations of African Americans. We had 250 years of enslavement in this country versus we're just, you know, getting over 150 years or so of freedom. What that means is for the majority of the time that black people have been in this country, they've been enslaved. The expectation that you will take all of that into consideration, to say nothing about Jim Crow, to say nothing about the era of lynching, to say nothing about this era that we live in right now, where the people who I pay my taxes to protect me don't have the same relationship to me as they do in other communities, that one should somehow in some sort of literary way at the end of the day say, but everything's going to be okay. Is it? How do you know that? How do you know everything's going to be okay? My job is to tell the truth as I see it. You know, I'm not anybody's pastor. I'm not anybody's prophet. That's not my job, you know. But I think for a lot of black writing, because this thing is so close to the bone of who we are as an American, this is the idea that you should get a bedtime story. And I'm just not going to do that. I'll never do that. It'd be a massive betrayal, you know, of the form.
That's Ta-Nehisi Coates. His new collection of his essays written for The Atlantic, including his thoughts about them now, We Were 8 Years in Power, an American Tragedy. Ta-Nehisi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
College basketball is dealing with a stunning bribery scandal. The FBI this week arrested 10 people, including 4 assistant coaches, on charges of fraud and corruption. Louisville has effectively fired head coach Rick Pitino over his program's alleged ties to the scandal. The charges were the result of a 3-year FBI probe that focused on coaches being paid tens of thousands of dollars to steer NBA-bound players toward agents, financial advisors, and apparel companies. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com, and he joins us now. Mike, tell us more about how this worked. Who was allegedly paying these coaches?
A constellation of interests, including people who represented allegedly, let's just throw out the adverb allegedly for all this, because we understand these are charges and not proven,
right.
But people who worked for sneaker companies, people who worked for agents, and at bottom, the college athletes are an asset worth potentially in the future millions of dollars. And for a short period of time when they're in college, they get paid nothing. So to leverage that situation, an assistant coach or someone who is perhaps connected to a player might get paid by a future agent, might get paid by a shoe company to steer that player to the shoe company. And that is illegal. That is what the U.S. Attorney's Office has charged.
And one of the accused is Jim Gatto of Adidas, the sports apparel company. And prosecutors say he actually used company money to pay high school students and their families to go to colleges that outfit their teams in Adidas gear. Are they saying anything about this?
Well, Adidas is waiting for the investigation to play out, of course. But, you know, it was known that this goes on, and it was assumed that it would go on at a level that was pretty high up in companies. I don't think the exact dollar amounts were known. We're talking about charges, including wire fraud and money laundering, for $100,000 to the family of one recruit, $150,000 to the family of another recruit. And think about what they're doing. They're paying someone to go to, essentially, to go to a college and wear Adidas sneakers while at college. It's such a bizarre incentive structure I mean, it really does get down to the fact that these athletes are supplying a whole, as I said, constellation of people with hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. And because there's this imposition of amateurism on them, they can't pay everyone else who can get paid. All the adults can get a little bit of a taste, and it leads to corruption, and it leads to, you know, now criminality.
Well, and do you think that a scandal like this will move the needle on the question of whether we should just be paying college athletes?
I think it's very hard. I think the NCAA is wedded to their definitions of amateurism, and it has moved it a little bit to allow players to get paid for. You know, players weren't even actually getting 100% of the costs paid for college in terms of their scholarships and like their housing costs and their food. I think the biggest thing, aside from the criminal charges, to come out of this is that Rick Pitino, coach of Louisville, has effectively been canned.
Right.
And this guy's a Hall of Fame coach, and that's going to have reverberations. College basketball, college football is a little different. There's so much money, and where they get their money isn't directly from the NCAA. But with college basketball, the NCAA makes so much money on the March Madness tournament that I think there is areas for reform. I don't know how far they'll go, though.
That's Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
So how is Megyn Kelly doing? The former Fox News personality made headlines after then-candidate Donald Trump attacked her during the campaign. She switched to NBC, where her specials didn't impress critics that much, but she made her debut on a morning show this week with pieces on the Menendez brothers and nurses caring for opioid-dependent infants, and some criticism from some celebrity guests. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has been watching. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
And let's listen to a little tape from yesterday's show. Megyn Kelly was interviewing stars Robert Redford and Jane Fonda. Their new movie is Our Souls at Night. After she asks Redford when he first knew he had become a popular sex symbol, Megyn Kelly says this to Jane Fonda.
You've been an example to everyone in how to age beautifully and with strength and unapologetically. You admit you've had work done, which I think is to your credit. But you look amazing. Why did you say, I read that you said you felt you're not proud to admit that you've had work done. Why not?
We really want to talk about that now?
Well, social media lit up. Actress Sarah Michelle Gellar asked why Megyn Kelly didn't ask Robert Redford about having work done. David, your thoughts?
Well, look, let's start with the recognition that Megyn Kelly really came up in television at Fox News. And that's a place that, by and large, tends to drum out the human impulse of empathy, except when it serves certain kinds of ideological interests here. And yet Kelly was occasionally able there to show glints of humanity and cut against the ideological strain on Fox. Here, she's trying to connect. She said this would be a politics-free zone. You would not have seen her interviewing sympathetically Robert Redford, Jane Fonda, two avatars of the Hollywood liberal left. On her old Fox News show. And here she is trying to show that she can do that. And yet she gets in this awkward thing where she's talking about somebody's looks at a time and more than their looks, talking about what plastic surgery they've had done in Hollywood, a place that tends to demand such things of their aging stars, without doing so in a way that this person wanted to engage with. And it was a human but very awkward kind of a tense moment.
Well, go to what you were talking about. When Megyn Kelly was at Fox, she would mock Jane Fonda. She criticized Michelle Obama for complimenting Fonda. And here is Kelly with comic Dennis Miller.
So do you know Jane Fonda? Do you circulate in the same circle?
She was a great Barbarella.
Oh, but then things went south.
I think she made big errors when she quit being Barbarella. She made sense to me then.
And Megyn Kelly laughs while Dennis Miller mocks Jane Fonda. Look at Fox, Jane Fonda's Hanoi Jane, who posed during the Vietnam War with the Viet Cong. Is that part of the awkwardness of a Megyn Kelly shifting to NBC?
Look, I think that any new show deserves time, a series of months before it's fully judged on the merits. And I think that Megyn Kelly is even though she's been away from Fox for many months now, is still deprogramming that side of her. I don't know that she was particularly ideological when she was saying those things about Jane Fonda, but it played to the audience. Here she has a very different daytime, largely female audience that in some ways oversubscribes on people of color, the kinds of folks who some of her programming and certainly much of Fox News's opinion programming often served to alienate. So she's really having to pivot here and show a different side of herself, and it's been an awkward first few days.
Well, and there was also on the very first episode, she brought up the stars of Will and Grace. She made a joke, which people didn't take as a joke, about a super fan who loved the show Will and Grace, which featured gay actors. She said to the fans, so you became a lawyer and you became gay because of the character. It was a pretty good joke, but it feels as if people are unable maybe to hear her without the prism they're going to attach to her.
Well, look, you know, somebody responded on Instagram to remarks by Deborah Messing, one of the main stars, Grace, of Will and Grace. And she said he said he was disappointed with her in sort of playing ball and being there with Megyn Kelly on her NBC show. Deborah Messing wrote back on Instagram that she regretted it and thought she was just there for the 9 a.m. hour. She claimed not to even know that Megyn Kelly was the lead host of that. I think that we've got to give Kelly time to adapt. And at the same time, she has to recognize she comes with a certain baggage. She's going to have to earn every viewer.
Yeah. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik on Megyn Kelly's new morning show, transitioning from Fox to NBC with some bumps. David, thank you.
You bet.
And staying with television, we want to follow up on the conversation we had earlier this week with filmmakers Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. The final episode of their 18-hour documentary, The Vietnam War, airs tonight on PBS. No more war, USA. Right there, you hear the tension of that era. Here now is Peter O'Dowd is back. And Peter, this week you brought us the filmmakers and a little with Daniel Ellsberg, the military analyst who leaked the Pentagon Papers in 1971. These were the top secret government papers, the study of the war commissioned by Defense Secretary Robert McNamara. And today we wanted to hear a little more about Ellsberg.
Right. And that document that Ellsberg leaked, the Pentagon Papers, was proof that for decades, the highest levels of the U.S. government had been misleading the American public about the involvement in the Vietnam War. And the documents played a huge role turning the American public's tide against the war. So I wanted to make sure that Ellsberg had seen the entire film before we spoke, which he did. So did a guy named John McAuliffe, who was a peace activist at the time. He joined us for the conversation. McAuliffe led a group called the Committee of Returned Volunteers, and he was at many of the major protests in the 1960s and 70s.
And they felt that there were some major omissions in the film.
Yeah, they did. You know, both men said that they liked the film. It was a great feat of filmmaking. But McAuliffe says he thought the depiction of the war protests were done in little bits and pieces throughout the 18 hours and without full explanation. And, you know, he uses the 1967 march on the Pentagon as an example of this. Here's an excerpt of my conversation with both of the men about that day.
Both Dan and I were at the Pentagon march in different capacities. And it's worth talking about that. We're actually
I was writing the Pentagon Papers as a RAND consultant to the Defense Department. I did march. And then I went inside the Pentagon, actually, with my Pentagon pass at that point.
To work on
No,
that
to
project.
Watch from inside. I actually went in. The Pentagon Papers were being written in an office next to McNamara's office. And it was a Saturday, and I think it had been suggested that people not come in. So the office that I was in was almost deserted. And I went next door to McNamara's office, and he was standing there watching from a window. And I stood at another window and looked down at the arrests in the crowd.
And I was down there.
Sympathizing with him.
I mean, I think that's what – I mean, it's a good example of what gets left out. The film goes just as far as people moving towards the Pentagon and some initial confrontations with military, but it doesn't at all describe what's happening, the 1,000-plus people sitting on the Pentagon steps, people singing America the Beautiful, draft cards being burned, that backside of the story of the nonviolent civil disobedience, the, in a sense, patriotic, I characterize it as the last patriotic peace demonstration. And I just don't get the film communicating any of that dimension of what was going on in people's lives. Huh.
And all the while, you were outside the Pentagon. Daniel Ellsberg was inside as the Pentagon Papers were being written. Dan, did you know at that time that you would do what you would do with those papers?
No, by no means, not at all. I was helping write them at that point.
But
in
you say you were sympathetic.
We're talking about 67. In my memory, I would extend what John said to two later events. First of all, the draft resistance, the enormous nonviolent draft resistance, in which 180,000 Americans' files were referred for charges by the Justice Department for non-cooperation with the draft, and 4,000 people went to prison, people like Bob Eaton, David Harris, Randy Keeler in particular, none of whom were shown in the film. In fact, their existence was not even mentioned in the film. The draft resistors who went to prison, not to Canada. In terms of the power of that action on my life, I would say without those draft resistors, no Pentagon Papers for what that was worth.
Peter, what an incredible image of Daniel Ellsberg standing with McNamara looking at the protesters.
Yeah.
And we know that years later, McNamara apologized for the Vietnam War. What an image. So do you think their criticism is fair?
Well, look, the filmmakers covered a lot of territory on the protest movement. The riots at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, the Kent State shooting, the protest at Columbia University, the teach-ins, the vets who came back from the war and then joined the protest movement. But I do think it's amazing that even in a documentary that's 18 hours long, there's still a feeling among people like Ellsberg and McAuliffe who lived it, who felt that there were still important things left out. And that's just got to speak to how complex and how chaotic and how much turmoil there was in that era.
Here now is Peter O'Dowd. Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
And later today, we'll post our earlier interviews with David Ellsberg about how he hid and copied those Pentagon Papers. That'll be at herenow.org.
As the rhetoric has heated up between the U.S. and North Korea, defense experts have been wondering, could the U.S. or its allies actually shoot down a missile launched by North Korea? Joining us now is Ian Williams, Associate Director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's in Washington. Ian Williams, what's the answer? Does the U.S. have the capability to shoot down a missile?
Yes, it most likely could. There's a lot of variables. If we wanted to shoot down, the greater challenge would be shooting actually down a missile that was fired as a test. You know, our missile defense systems in the region are deployed in such a way that they can defend places, cities, people, military bases. They're not necessarily ideally, optimally positioned to, say, intercept a missile that's headed towards the middle of the Pacific Ocean like Kim Jong-un has been doing. So that's one complication, but they're certainly in place if North Korea ever actually fired a missile at something that really threatened something.
How do we know that we have the capability to do that, though?
Well, the systems that we have deployed have undergone pretty extensive testing. One of the systems we have in the region is the Patriot system, and this system has been proven. We see it working very well in the Yemen conflict. Saudi Arabia has deployed Patriots against missiles coming out of Yemen fired by Houthi rebels. And from what we can tell, they've hit everything they fired at. The THAAD system, for example, has a 100% success rate in tests. The Aegis system has been tested since the 90s and has about an 85% success rate in tests. So these are pretty reliable.
We were speaking recently with Jim Walsh about this. He's at the Security Studies Program at MIT, and he said the problem would be that if we were to shoot down one of North Korea's missiles, that we'd then have to do that every time after that they, you know, shot a missile into the air, because otherwise, either you miss the first time or you miss the fourth time, you prove that you don't always have the ability to shoot the missile down.
Yeah, I would agree with the sense from a policy perspective that if we start trying to shoot down the North Korea test launches that are just firing into the ocean, then what do you do about the next one? What do you do about the next one? And my big concern about that is really starting to strain the inventory of interceptors. And that inventory would start running down pretty quickly, and we may not be prepared if they did actually fire something that really threatens something.
Let me just go back to the overall picture with North Korea. What do you think of what's going on right now and the rhetoric between Kim Jong-un and President Trump?
Well, it's pretty unprecedented. I mean, usually North Korea has had the monopoly on the kind of the bombast and the kind of inflammatory rhetoric. I'm starting to think that they don't quite know what to do now that they're getting some of it in return. It certainly has lent to an unpredictable situation where the risk of miscalculation, which could lead to conflict, is probably higher than it would otherwise be.
Are you concerned about it?
Yes, I am concerned about it. I think, you know, if a conflict did start on the Korean Peninsula, I think, you know, the combined forces of the United States, South Korea, and Japan would prevail, but the cost of that would be very high. I mean, I think there's Pentagon estimates saying that there could be as many as 20,000 people killed a day in the initial days of the conflict. So,
and a lot of those people, not in North Korea, but in South Korea or even in
South Korea and in North Korea. And that's assuming that the conflict didn't go nuclear.
Right.
And certainly there's a lot of other threats that North Korea poses beyond the nuclear threat. They have a lot of artillery, for example, that could bombard Seoul. That would be a barrage like nothing we've seen since World War II or even World War I. They also have large stockpiles of other kinds of weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, biological weapons. We saw that demonstrated with the assassination of Kim Jong-un's half-brother with VX nerve agent. We also believe they may have large stockpiles of anthrax. You imagine a weaponized anthrax weapon fired at a port that would be used to normally be used to bring in more U.S. forces to the region, making those kinds of points of embarkation and points of debarkation for military forces inoperable could really complicate our response and ultimately make the war more costly and deadly.
So given all of that and the issue that you brought up a moment ago that there could be an accidental trigger for some kind of conflict, mm-hmm. would your advice be to the United States to tone down the rhetoric?
I think so. Again, it's possible that a more aggressive rhetoric might ultimately deter North Korea from continuing to push the envelope. That doesn't seem to be what we've seen. We've seen arguably the greatest provocations that we've ever seen from North Korea in just the past few months, with the tests of an ICBM, the tests of a hydrogen bomb. So it's kind of an alarming trend. There's just so much uncertainty here that I think everyone needs to take a breath.
That's Ian Williams, who is Associate Director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Ian Williams, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.